Luke Roman, president and founder of FFTT Forest for the Trees. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me back on, Tom. It's great to be here.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Luke. I always, you know, really look forward to and maybe spend a little bit of extra time prepping for our conversations, thinking about what I want to cover with you today. And I think a good place to kind of start here is really zooming out for the bigger picture for the U.S. right now. You know, national debt has now reached $39.5 trillion. 10-year rates are within 10% of their five-year highs. Defense spending is consistently rising as purchasing power is just consistently being eroded, despite what CPI might come in at and, you know, the market reacts to there. So much of this points squarely at Warsh and Bessent and what their strategies are going forward. They're likely going to have a very difficult fiscal and monetary situation to manage. So starting with the Fed under Warsh, is he able to actually make choices about how to solve these problems? Or is the path ahead kind of laid out mostly for him by the math?
I think he still has choices. I just think they're all unpleasant to varying degrees, right? He can raise rates as much as he wants and be a tough guy on inflation. But the math means he's going to create treasury market dysfunction and risk off in equity markets. And then very quickly, he will face a choice that has been presented over and over the last 6-7 years to Fed chair people and Yellen, Powell, and soon Warsh, and Treasury secretaries over those 6 to 7 years, which is, do you want to allow the Treasury market to dysfunction, or do you want to maintain functioning of the Treasury market and weaken the dollar? And that's the choice he's going to face. Now, it is in a trickier position, arguably, than Powell or Yellen, because of the math. The debt is higher. We've spent the last 2.5-3 years shifting issuance of debt forward, and so the Treasury role is rising exponentially. In terms of, you know, over the next 12 months, I think Treasury needs to refinance $8 trillion worth, right? So there's that makes things trickier faster. It means raising rates is going to push the U.S. into fiscal dominance even faster, even harder. It's going to expand the deficit even faster because all that short-term debt reprices almost instantly for after nearly 3 years of shifting issuance to the front end. So at the same time, you know, Bessent has options. He has generally pursued the same things that Yellen has pursued in terms of shifting issuance forward, even though he criticized Yellen for doing so when Yellen was doing it. But why is he doing what he criticized as a private citizen? Because the math is the math. There's nothing else he can do. There are discussions that there can be regulatory change where essentially the banks QE, you know, they buy more treasuries. If you reduce regulations, banks can buy more treasuries and they can continue to lend to the U.S. private sector. That could work. That is still ultimately weakening the dollar. There's talk about that stable coins are sort of the Hail Mary to save the treasury market. And again, could it work? Yes, but there's some conditions to that. And in the end, you're still talking about shifting issuance to the front end. You're basically financing the U.S. deficits increasingly in cash-like markets, in bill markets with low yield. And, you know, to understand what that implies for the economy, for inflation, for the dollar, understand that the dollar is just a 0% yielding note of zero duration. Well, if you're going to finance the deficit, increasing deficits with T-bills backed by or stable coins backed by T-bills, you are going to be financing the deficit with a 0% yielding or near 0% yielding instrument of near zero duration. In other words, stablecoins are basically cash financing the deficit, which again, it's fine. It's an option. It has huge, you know who else financed the deficit? Cash finance the deficit? Weimar. Like every great inflation, and I'm not saying we're going to become Weimar, and that's not what stablecoins are. I'm simply using, extremes inform the means. And when you're shifting toward cash, effectively cash financing more of your debt and deficits, it's inflationary, full stop. Mm-hmm. And that's really the choice. It's do you want inflation or do you want your bond market to essentially dysfunction and stay dysfunctioning? And they're not going to allow the latter. And so that kind of, go back to option one. And mm-hmm. they keep going back to option one with different sort of calling it different things, saying it's different things, denying it's QE, blah, blah, blah. Weaken the dollar, let the treasury market dysfunction. Those are his choices. Neither are pleasant.
Yeah, it's interesting to kind of think about stablecoins as being sold as this idea that can save things, yet it's just another form of debt financing by a different color or a different name, right?
Yeah, you're effectively using sort of the velocity, the monetary velocity, the economic velocity of the US to back the debt. And that isn't a horrible idea by any stretch. But again, it depends on how it's structured. Because look, as I've got some assets, am I going to put them in stable coins? No, because I'm going to keep them in money markets, right? Any corporate treasurer worth their salt is not going to go into stable coins at 0% yield when they can earn 4% in T-bills. Mm-hmm. Why would you go to T-bill backed stable coins at zero or 50 basis points when you can make 4% in T-bills? In a cash equivalent money, right? So a huge chunk of cash that they're hoping to basically do this with isn't going to go there. Will people in Africa be interested in it? Sure. What are we talking about in terms of money? It ain't that much.
And that's what I was going to say is like the argument can be made that it makes it a little bit more, the US Treasury market is more accessible for the rest of the world in that case. But again, how much does that really represent in the overall demand for treasuries, right?
It's not that big a number in the grand scheme of what we need. Mm-hmm. And it also shows a level of hubris around regarding what is actually valued by people in the world mm-hmm. and what is actually... And what that decision set means. And what I mean by that is go to Africa. Who's the biggest trading partner with Africa? It's not even close. It's Chinese. Mm-hmm. When we go to Africa, we Larry Summers, the US comes, we get a lecture. The Chinese come, we get an airport. That's what Larry Summers said. After meeting with one emerging market leader or another, 5 or 6 years ago. So the biggest trading partner, let's run through the logic here. The stablecoin folks, Hail Mary, that will save us all, without pain. We're going to be saved one way or another. Like, we're fine. It's just the degree of, pain-free financing of the U.S. deficit because Africa's going to buy all our debt via stablecoins, Well, if it's a 0% yielding stablecoin or very low yielding stablecoin, and yes, I get it. Their currencies are crappy relative to the dollar. But if you're in Africa, would you rather have a dollar or would you rather have some Chinese-made good that improves your life? Mm-hmm. Would you rather have solar panels that bring electricity to your house, that power your – would you rather – right? And what do the Americans make? Would you rather have a BYD car? Would you rather have, a battery backup? Because, by the way, your country's electric infrastructure stinks too. It's not just its currency. So you can have a dollar or – you can have a Chinese EV array with Chinese lithium ion battery storage with a Chinese BYD car that's dirt cheap and gets you everywhere. What are you going to buy? You're going to buy at least some of your money you're going to spend on all that. Now, what are the Chinese going to, what's the Chinese stablecoin offering? Well, we've been talking about, gold-backed stablecoins. Okay, well, if you can have a 0% yielding dollar backed stablecoin by a country that's not really selling you anything of value to improve the quality of your life today, other than, hey, here's a currency that doesn't go down as fast as your currency, while the Chinese are offering you, hey, here's something that we can use to make your quality of living definably better today. And here's a yuan stablecoin and it's gold backed. What are you going to put at least some in the yuan stable? And you bet you are. Absolutely you are. There's no question. So especially since yuan's risen against the dollar over the last 2 years, right? So, you know, that to me, again, it's hubris. Why are we not hearing this? And you know why we're not hearing this from our leaders of that are pushing the stablecoin thing or the analysts? Because they don't have an answer for it. Mm-hmm. Right. Anytime you don't hear people talk about things, it's it's because they don't want to talk about it because there's nothing to say. They, you know, hey, look at my card. It is, you know, I've got a great hand. It's, you know, 10 of clubs high or jack of clubs high. And it's awesome. And, you know, and the player next to you has got like two aces. And, well, he's got two aces. No. Don't worry about that. Look at my cards. Right. So that's kind of what we're watching here, I think. And again, it doesn't mean stablecoins won't have a place. It doesn't mean that some of what they're talking about can work. It just means it's not going to work as much as they think, and it's not going to work as fast as they think. And that then we go back to, hey, the fiscal and debt side is a problem now. We got next 12 months, $8 trillion to roll, and it's increasing exponentially because we've spent the last 2.5-3 years shifting issuance forward because we can't issue at the long end without blowing out rates that lead to a risk off and a debt spiral for the US and for much of the West. Mm-hmm.
So before we get, let's say, too far down the China versus US road, thinking about, let's say, Warsh's counterpart in some ways at the Treasury, is Scott Bessent's playbook or strategy going forward to basically favor higher tariffs and to have some neutral floating reserve asset in order to be able to continue to operate and maybe give the Treasury market a better anchor or more functionality in this time, let's say for the next decade or so, looking up.
Yeah, I think as you go back 4 weeks, Bessent, I think, said something super important that markets are still not paying enough attention to, in my opinion. He gave a speech at the New York Economic Club about Hamiltonian economics. And in case anybody thought he was just speaking out of turn or off the cuff, he published a Wall Street Journal op-ed the same day saying Trump economic statecraft is based on Hamiltonian economics. What are Hamiltonian economics? High tariffs, increased production, increased autarky, you know, self-reliance within critical sectors. And by definition, you have to have a neutral reserve asset. You need to settle your deficits in a neutral reserve asset in that case. You can't settle your deficits in IOUs of a financial economy in that case. That's what that means. And it was really interesting to me that he said these things, because it echoes what U.S. Trade Representative Greer announced in Davos this year, shortly before the whole Iran mistake, debacle, whatever. Greer came out and announced to Davos, the U.S. is moving to Hamiltonian economics. He literally said that, literally. I'm only slightly paraphrasing. And he specifically cited John Maynard Keynes as bankor at Bretton Woods, specifically cited Bretton Woods, that you need a neutral commodity-backed asset to settle trade in. It was a mind-blowing speech. Mm-hmm. Everyone was focused on, you know, what Carney said and all these, you know, sort of all of the infighting that was happening amongst the, you know, the rules-based global order elites, or, you know, the what was once known as, or the now dead rules-based global order. Everyone was focused on what they were saying. No one paid attention to this Greer speech. So now you've got the U.S. Trade Representative, who, by the way, Wall Street Journal 2 weeks ago said is making an increased clout within the Trump administration for economic policy. You've got Greer reiterating those views with the New York Times in an interview 2 days ago. You've got Bessent saying in a speech to the titans of industry in New York, and then the same day in the Wall Street Journal in an op-ed that he authored, the same thing. You go back to Vance last year at Davos, the stupid Washington consensus that deindustrialized America. This is the vice president of the United States calling the Washington consensus rules-based global order stupid, and it deindustrialized us. So you put him in the Hamiltonian economics camp. And then you had Trump last year say, I want to get us back to when we were the richest we ever were, which was 1870 to 1913, when we were taxing foreigners to support our country as opposed to taxing Americans to support other countries. What came in 1913? The Fed. Oh, he wants to go back to a Hamiltonian economic system. I'm not saying he's going to get rid of the Fed, but he's going to degrade the Fed or de-emphasize the Fed. How do you do that? Neutral reserve asset. You know, what did Volcker famously say, right? Gold is my enemy. Gold's not the enemy. Gold's just the temperature gauge. You know, you're in Phoenix. Temperature gauge says 110 in Phoenix in July. Is the temperature gauge your enemy? No, you're in Phoenix in July, dude. Gold's not your enemy. You spent a bunch of money in Vietnam on you know, guns and butter. Like, that's your enemy. Anyway, I think this Hamiltonian economics thing, I think, is where they need to be. I think it's the right – I think they are laying out the strategy. We've had this detour of Iran that is ongoing, that is messing up – risking their legacy, really. But I think the legacy saver, the legacy driver, the thing that could literally have Trump with his – you know, where people would agree – that his head should be on Mount Rushmore, or added to Mount Rushmore, is this shift back to Hamiltonian economics. And so they're all talking about it. I think it's super interesting. I think it's super important. And to me, that's like the North Star of the strategy. That's where they're trying to head. And then you've got sort of the slings and arrows of the nonsense in Iran and the nonsense in, you know, Epstein and the nonsense and all this other stuff. That's just, they're distractions. Like, you've got to get back to the Hamilton. And so to me, it's very interesting to see Bessent talking about this and the rest of the administration at the highest levels doing so as well. Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, you know, a part of the Hamiltonian economics, not only being, you know, trying to, let's say, raise tariffs, but the other side of it would be to increase production and manufacturing capacity within the US. I was recently reading one of your reports where you wrote about the fact or the idea that it would cost the West in general $23 trillion and take 25 years to cut their reliance on China. So is this even a reasonable goal to add that expense to the run rate of already deficit spending and to try to bring all of this manufacturing capacity, refining capacity back to the West?
So that was an article in the FT, I think citing it was either a Bain or McKinsey study. I think it was a McKinsey study, 23 trillion, 25 years. Is that feasible? Sure. It's like the old saw, right? You can have something quickly, done well, cheaply. Pick two.
Yeah.
So the US can reshore well and cheaply, but it's going to take a really long time. Mm-hmm. Or it can reshore well and quickly, but it's going to be really expensive. Mm-hmm. Or the U.S. can reshore crappily, in which case we're going to lose, and it will be cheap and it will take a long time, or it'll be quick. It'll be cheap and quick.
Yeah.
That's where we are. And again, it's really ultimately, can we do it? Sure, we can do anything we want. The question isn't, can we do it? The question is, what's the inflation rate and what's the political fallout? Mm-hmm. You've had lots of people say, we can do it. Look what we did in 1940, 1945. You see that go back to the advertising, even in America. I'm sure you've seen it now, right? Like Dodge and others are like, hey, we said we would do it in World War II and we did it. I was like, are you really making a war 85 years ago part of your marketing campaign in 2026? What? Why? Well, because not like they're going to be like, hey, we sold Jeeps in Vietnam. No one wants to be attached to that, you know, goat rodeo. Hey, we sold Jeeps, you know, right? You know, we made the component on the Hummer in Iraq War II that like completely destroyed the finances of America. Well, let's leave that out. Hey, we had to take a bailout in the GFC. Okay, let's go back to World War II. Let's spin that. Woo-hoo! Okay. 1940-1945, yeah, we did do it. The United States ran a 25% of GDP deficit. The United States' marginal tax rate on the highest taxpayers was 90 to 95%. The United States had unemployment going into that war of near 12 to 15%. So they had labor. That labor force, by the way, knew what the hell it was doing and could make stuff, which it can't anymore. We're seeing that everywhere. It was a manufacturing. And when I say by that, I don't mean to denigrate the workforce, but I mean to say from a labor workforce, we had a manufacturing centric workforce that we no longer do anymore in any way, shape, or form after 40 years of financialization and offshoring.
A skills base.
Skills base. And by the way, the U.S. government shifted issuance to the front end. They're doing the same thing now. And the Fed's balance sheet rose 10x in 5 years, 4 years, really, because it was really 1942 to 1946. So can we do it? We absolutely can do it. All we need to do is run 25% plus deficits. We need to increase taxes massively at the high end to basically stop hyperinflation, which is why they did in World War II. You need to institute capital controls, which they had in World War II, which, by the way, ends dollar reserve status. You can't have capital controls, draconian capital controls on the reserve currency as it is structured post-1971. You need to figure out where the heck you're going to find all of those laborers. You need to have the Fed grow its balance sheet, and then you need to deal with the political fallout of inflation that's probably going to be 20% plus for the next 5 years. So can we do it? Absolutely, we can do it. Those are the costs. Now, then we can debate how likely is that? How politically feasible is that? And the answer is it's probably not that likely. It's probably not that politically feasible. And yet, they need to do it. So that's the tricky part, right? That's, you know, to me, the Hamiltonian economics, that's where they want to be. That's the aspirational. This is what we want to do. Well, here's what you got to do to get there. You know what? Let's just go start a war in Iran instead. It's so much easier. We've got muscle memory there. You know, we can just go muck things up in the Middle East for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. Like, yeah, do that instead. See how that works for you. It went so well last time.
I mean, we're not making light of the situation, but you know, the absurdity of the situation is absolutely not lost on me. But you know, Luke, I was listening to a podcast the other day about the AI data center build out. And even from a regulatory standpoint, thinking about the fast tracking of instituting mines, smelters, growing this manufacturing base, they were making the point that if you were today in this environment to try to propose something like the railroad system, just that alone would be such a difficult sell to the American people, right? The idea of eminent domain and taking over people's land in order to put a cross-continental transit system in would be the resistance to it would be unbelievable now. And to be able to push this through in the environment that exists today, I think is another part of this that is maybe underappreciated.
Yeah, you need a crisis to do it, right? And even then, you know, how do you generate the crisis? you know, what is the crisis? You know, financial crisis, you can't really have because it blows up the treasury market. Now you're done. Okay. So set that aside. I mean, you can let stocks go down for a little, but you can't let stocks go down 10, 15% without the treasury market start to dysfunction. We saw that in March. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Without
we've seen
treasury
it repeatedly before then.
Falling.
What's that?
Without treasury receipts falling as well.
That's exactly right. So you can't do that. So, okay, well, what about a war? You know, what about a terrorist attack? Well, people are so jaded around, like, we've been at war for 25 years. The American public is done with wars. Like, I don't think, you know, it'd be really hard to say, hey, this is imminent. Look at Trump's ratings around Iran. You know, we've been here for 40 years that these guys are 2 weeks from having a nuke. We've been at war for 25 years trying to prevent people in the Middle East from getting weapons of mass destruction. Oh, by the way, the first time we went and sort of ran up $8 trillion in debt for nothing, we couldn't find the WMDs, could we? So there's a great degree of skepticism around that angle as well. So I don't see how, and in the meantime, to your point, you know, one of my good friends, he's coined the term idea machine, which is, hey, we're going to reindustrialize US. Great. Who cannot be for that? There's mines in Utah, right? There's these massive, you look up and down the Rockies, there's all of these mineral deposits, you know, rare earths and all this stuff we need. Great. We're going to go get it. Great. How are you going to get out of the ground? I don't know. Where's the plan to run the electricity in there? I don't know. What's the lead time on the, you know, on the drag lines to get up there? I don't know. Who's going to make the drag lines? I don't know. When are you going to put the rail lines down to get the stuff back out? I don't know. How long is it going to take? I don't know. Who's going to make the steel? I don't know. Right? Idea machine. Who can be against producing more of our own raw material? But then when it comes to the actual execution, perfect example, real life, we're seeing in Ohio right now. 2022, hey, Intel's coming in to make chips in Ohio. Great. I tweeted, I was excited about it. Great. 2022, break ground. Great. Look at this. Yesterday, SK Hynix looking at buying the plant. Why? Well, it was supposed to be up and running by 2025. It's not even close. It's cost overrun. Best case is now is 2030, 2031 that'll be done. Best case. Idea machine. It's symptomatic of something that if you ask anyone in manufacturing, anyone in consumer goods, I mean, we brag of it. People brag about it. We're really good at ideas, and then the Chinese are really good at execution. You have an idea in manufacturing, you can literally call. An engineer told me this last week. You can literally call from Texas. You can call China at 1 p.m. in Texas. So that's what? 2 a.m? Someone picks up the phone, says, I'll have you some rough blueprints by 4 p.m. your time. And they do. And 3 days later, there's a working test in Texas. Maybe 4 days later. Mm-hmm. How do you compete with that? Like that's the opposite of idea machine. Hey, I have an idea for this. And then they make it, design it, blah, blah, blah. And then they steal it from you. Like, and sell it back cheap. That's how this is. And so it keeps coming back to the same thing, which is we can do it, but we can't do it and preserve the real value of the dollar, the real value of the bond market. You need to go to Hamiltonian economics where you have tariffs to defend what you're making. And then you're going to have to crush the dollar, probably against gold, probably against the yuan. If you want to do this, otherwise we're going to stay on the same path, which is we're going to keep fighting in Iran and fill in the blank other place. And the Chinese will make more and more of the components for us to do that until the Chinese say, we're not selling you that stuff anymore because it's not now we're in charge geopolitically. And we're kind of already there with rare earths, right? Like how many times have we heard missiles, you know, missile air defense missiles are in tight supplies. The Chinese are constraining rare earth defense. Like, we're not all the way there yet, but we're heading in that direction. We can see clear that. So that's, you know, again, it's all just about trade-offs and choices.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what I was going to bring up is if your idea is to move away from reliance on China, how do you get there without China saying, oh, that's what you're up to? Okay, well, we're going to continue to restrict access to things like helium, things like tungsten or rare earths, as you pointed out.
Well, and for the U.S., right, like, you know, China is restricting helium. They don't really produce a lot. They're a net, big net importer. So that to me is an admission of weakness or concern of weakness. You know, the U.S. is the biggest exporter of helium. But no, I think that's exactly right. I think it ultimately comes down to policy and a willingness to stick by your own deals. Neither side's sticking by their own deals. Everyone says, oh, the Chinese never keep to a deal. No, it's fair. It's probably more like you need to be very specific about what you say, because if you leave any wiggle room, they find it, right? It's like, you know, as a friend of mine in China said, like, is a flight from Shanghai to Hong Kong a domestic flight or international? I said, well, domestic, right? He goes, no, it's international. I'm like, but he goes, strategic ambiguity. That's what they do. But look, the U.S. hasn't kept its word either for a long time. Like, the Iraq war was a violation of the UN. It was a, you know, the rules-based global, we've been violating the rules-based global order that we set up over and over and over and over. You've heard a number of other people on other sides of our conflict saying that they're not deal, not deal ready or not deal capable. That's what it is. The United States is no longer deal capable. Whatever they say, they immediately break, right? Like, you know, you need a $10 million bounty on the head of the guy who's now running Syria. He was like an ISIS guy, and now he's in the White House shaking Trump's hand. Like, what? Like, come on. That's just a sign we're not deal capable. So neither side is really deal capable in the other's eyes. So you would have to first fix that, which takes time and new leadership. And by new leadership, I mean people that stop saying, like, hey, you know, please send us stuff so we can make a weapon that we pointed at you and make you do what we want. Because I think all else equal, the Chinese would just rather do business. They would rather just, right? So we would have to take all of the sanctions we have on things like high-end chips and ASML machines off. And now we're in an honest-to-goodness free markets competition with the Chinese. There's a reason why they don't let BYD cars in America. They don't want to compete. They're scared to compete. And I'd be scared too. I look at our industrial base, what our own policy choices did to our industrial base over the last 40, 50 years. I'd be scared to compete too. They know they can't win. It would be like, you know, me saying, hey, Luke, you're going to go out and play Ohio State on Saturday. I'd be scared to death. I'm going to get killed, right? You're going to go fight. I don't know who the top MMA fighter is. You're going to go fight him this Saturday. No, I'm not. I'm going to get my ass kicked. That's what we're facing. So that's the tricky political part, right? You're right. Why would they? I wouldn't. And that means it's going to take longer. It's be more expensive, right? End of the day, it's going to take longer. It's going to be more expensive. I know what to do with that. Buy gold, sell long-term bonds. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting to think about this again, a little bit more strategically, thinking about many of the redundancies that China has built into its system. And I think for those that are paying attention, even let's say newly paying attention, this has been brought to the fore by the conflict in Iran, right? The idea that their penetration of EVs has given them this ability to continue to move people and products around the country with EVs. Even their SPR, right? Completely or almost completely shutting down oil imports to the tune of 5 million barrels per day, which helped cushion a lot of the energy crunch that many were predicting as part of this war. So moving to the oil idea, now with the SPR in the US at a far lower capacity or inventory level than we did have at the beginning of the year, if we continue to see, you know, the Strait of Hormuz closed, does this set us up for more of an oil catastrophe or an energy shock? If we see continued choking of oil, oil's ability to move around the world later this year?
Short answer is yes. Mm-hmm. You know, what I got wrong about the first part of this war, at least, I think I'm going to start to look like I'm going to be validated entirely. But what I got really wrong the first part of this war, I said, Hormuz, the war is going to last way longer than we think. Got that dead right. Hormuz is going to be closed longer than anybody thinks. I was saying May, June, and then I was saying at least July. And here we are. It's July 22nd. It's still closed. Mm-hmm. It opened there for a second. Got that dead right. If you'd have told me those two things, I'd been like, markets would be way lower. Supply chains would be way worse, etc. Got that dead wrong. Mm-hmm. Why? At least for now, to your question. I got that dead wrong at least for now. If this keeps up, I think I'm going to be right. But why did I get it wrong? China, number one. 3 to 4, 5 million barrels a day, they took down. And not only did they take down, anyone can, any big country can take oil consumption down 3-4 million barrels a day. Can they take it down and have corporate profits rise 20% year over year as they did in China in the second quarter? Can they take it down 3 to 4 million barrels a day and increase exports year over year by 27% the way China did? Can they do that while structurally reducing oil consumption by shifting to EVs? There's an estimate I saw last week, is in a piece I sent you that we put out for clients last week, was 1.4 million barrels a day of oil demand down by shifting to EVs. Wow. That's eminently replicable. They can do that. They can keep doing that along. And they ran down SPR. And so it's a really interesting dynamic, because when we came into this, you know, the other thing I got really right is China is not going to be worse, you know, the biggest at risk from this. You know, it was conventional wisdom. Trump's doing this to squeeze China, and China's screwed. Well, China wasn't screwed. In fact, this is helping China. As I look at the facts on the ground, if I'm China, I want this war to go on as long as it can. Why? I'm selling weapons and components to everyone on both sides of all these conflicts. Mm-hmm. China's trade surplus is at record highs. I have an ability. I still have SPR, and I have the ability to shift more and more of my population to EVs. And I've got plenty of electrical generation. So that's fine. And again, it's not that they can go forever, but this is a pain contest. Mm-hmm. And for them, this means that they can take pain way longer than the US, you know, treasury market, oil markets, et cetera, Europe. And then we're literally pushing the world into China's arms. I just saw a chart showed that in Asia, electric generation from solar is now higher than gas. Wow. What's Trump saying about all this?
We're going to buy gas.
Now the world's going to have to buy gas from America. Great, big, beautiful American gas. Come and get it. LNG. We've got all these new terminals. Buy gas from us, not from Qatar. No, buy from Qatar. I mean, my jet's from Qatar, but buy my gas from Qatar. Okay. But now Asia's generating more from solar panels. Who makes the solar panels? China. China's making all these solar panels. I don't know what to do. So China goes around and says, hey, we'll sell you solar panels, cheap. We'll sell you battery arrays, lithium ion, cheap. We'll sell you BYD cars, cheap. By doing this, you just separate yourself from the nonsense. These Americans, I have multiple different people in and around China going, what is it with you Americans and the Middle East? Like, haven't you learned your lesson? What are you doing? So Chinese can sit down and go, the Americans have... they're infatuated with the Middle East. They have a Middle East war fetish. And every time they do, it hurts you, because, you know, people are right. It does send oil prices up, which, you know, priced mostly in dollars, squeezes these countries. Sends a dollar up, squeezes these countries. Separate yourself. You can free up your dollar short problem you have swap lines with us in yuan. China has swap lines with everybody in the world, basically, except the Americans. Use your yuan swap line, buy it from us in yuan, set up these arrays. We'll teach you the know-how. You sell you cheap and just get rid of it. Now, all of a sudden, you're productively growing your economy. So what we're doing, what we thought would happen with this war, what the sort of 5D chess proponents would say would happen, which is it's going to shut down and choke off China and push, you know, them into a dollar crisis and the global south into a dollar crisis. And none of it's happening. 180 degrees opposite is happening. So, you know, if I'm China, let this thing go on as long as it can, because we, 2002, there's something called the Longer Telegram. It was written by a former Western senior official anonymously. It was written a few years back, and it said that the Chinese strategy was laid down in 2002 for dealing with America when they saw a, quote, period of unprecedented opportunity, a 20-year period of unprecedented opportunity while the Americans were distracted in Iraq. So now tell me, China's much stronger than they were in 2002. How do you think they feel about Iran? They've got to be going, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing it again. They're going to give us another 5, 10, 20-year period of strategic opportunity because they've got this fetish about Middle East wars. The Chinese have to be like, oh my God, wow, this is... It's very frustrating for me to just see that, like, how this is going to go so clearly. And yeah, people are cheering the Iran war. Finally, finally. That's what we said in friggin' 03, 04, too. You can go back and find people. You know, mm-hmm. Initially I was like, oh, I believe you, government. I believe you, American government. You know, yeah, let's go. And, you know, they must have WMA. My government would never lie to me. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me twice. Anyway, it's a little bit of a ramble, but I think China, the more this goes on, what we've seen with China's ability to adjust, and not just adjust and thrive, I think they're like, this is great. Because what does China want? What does China want strategically, ultimately? They've been saying it since 2009. They want a new currency system. They're on the same page as Besant is now with Hamiltonian economics. They want a neutral reserve asset. What's going to happen here at the end of the day? Western bond yields are going to hit high enough. They're going to have to do yield curve control in some form, which is going to really hit these currencies. It's going to send gold to the moon, and we're going to have our new system. Look, maybe that's the plan. Hey, let's go start a war in Iran. It creates a crisis. It lets us do whatever we want domestically, and it ultimately results in a change in the currency system that now we're on board with and the Chinese have been on board with the whole time. Possible. I think it's giving them too much credit, but it's possible. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. I did an interview with Craig Tyndale, and he recommended this book called Unrestricted Warfare. And it was written by two Chinese generals, I think in the mid-2000s.
99 originally.
Oh, okay. There you go. You know it well then.
And I own it, yeah.
It highlights much of these ideas of approaching warfare and learning from previous wars to become more strategic. And I think it's an absolutely excellent read to understand how China actually looks at these things and, you know, can in a lot of ways wage a war without having to necessarily fire a shot.
Well, and it's fascinating because when that guy wrote it, a guy's name Qiao Liang, he was a colonel mm-hmm. in the PLA, People's Liberation Army. He's now a general. Mm-hmm. So at least as of 10 years ago, he was a general. Right. So you don't go from colonel to general if what you're saying, A, they don't like, and B, isn't working.
Yeah.
So in 2015, he gave a speech to the Chinese Communist Party senior officials in which he said, among other things, the Americans picked the wrong enemy when they tried to fight China. They don't understand what's happening here. By virtue of big data, cloud computing, etc., they are undermining the dollar with their own big tech. Because once big tech gets to the point that you can instantly settle without the dollar, You know, if you have a hegemon, an empire that is based on the dollar, and then your own big tech and cloud computing, etc., allows instant settlement without the dollar by China and others. And he gave examples in 2014 of how much volume Baidu and Taobao and these internet applications, they were doing massive volumes 12 years ago without the dollar, off the dollar. He said, what happens to the empire that is dependent on the currency when the currency is no longer needed to settle trade? Mm-hmm. By virtue of their own cloud computing, big tech, financial innovations. He said, that is the questions the Americans should be thinking about. And then the next year, he said something along the lines of, if you want to attack America, you attack the debt. You know, cut off the financing. Well, what did China do in 2013? He said, we're done buying treasury bonds. He said, it's no longer in our interest to grow holdings of FX reserves, is what they officially said, November 2013. You can find it on Bloomberg. What they really said is we're done buying treasuries. And their holdings of treasuries haven't done anything since. And guess who has bought them? The Fed, U.S. banks, U.S. hedge funds. And what's gold done? When they said that, gold was, I don't know, 1,200 an ounce, 4,200 an ounce. You know, what's inflation in the U.S.? What's the treasury market, though, right? They're playing a longer game. And so that guy, yeah, it's very fascinating, that book, and it's very fascinating, this whole cloud computing / tech angle is undermining, it's creating the ability to undermine the dollar that the U.S. is relying on. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, to that point, Luke, how are China's AI models competing with this head start that the U.S. thought it had in AI and associated infrastructure?
I don't know specifically. I will say, I've been in this business for over 30 years now, which is astonishing to say, investment research. And if I had a nickel for every time I heard some version of, yeah, the Chinese will never catch us, followed by, the Chinese, they're actually producing, but it's terrible quality. It's not as good as ours. Followed by, oh, wow, you know, the Chinese are producing, and, you know, but it's still just cheaper. It's still not as good. Followed by, oh God, the Chinese are not just cheaper, but they're way better than us. Uh-oh. And if by the time you get to that last one, you start going, save us, Washington. Oh, we need help. I saw this in manufacturing, the U.S. Rust Belt. By the time you get to that stage, it's over. It's already, the game's already over. It's too late. You needed to start like, what's that?
I was going to say, which we have seen.
We just saw this week, right? You've got, Wall Street Journal yesterday. You've got, OpenAI and Anthropic going to Washington asking for help with the Chinese models, Wall Street Journal. 2 weeks ago, you had OpenAI offering the Trump administration a 5% stake. Like, what part of the last 30 years of American capitalism, American billionaires, have we seen where these billionaires just willingly give the government 5% stakes in their company out of the goodness of their hearts? I struggle to think of another instance of where that offer was made. I can remember 2008, the banks were given equity stakes. Things weren't going good then, were they? We've gotten ourselves into a math and engineering contest with the Chinese. that's like me going to play Ohio State this Saturday. Ooh. Now, we got a lot of smart people in this country. Mm-hmm. We can absolutely fix this. But when I see headlines like I saw yesterday, which is the Trump administration is moving funding from colleges to AI while also trying to raise defense spending up to $1.5 trillion, you kind of go, really? Now, American colleges are not efficient, right? Everyone's got new dorms, new stadiums, new this, that. That's part of the problem. That money should be going to engineer. Like, if you want to study engineering in America, if you stay for 4 years in engineering, you go for free. Full stop. Mm-hmm. You want to go on to your graduate degree? Great. We should be rating these kids, right? Like, you've got, my son played college baseball. you've got these college baseball rating systems all over the place, evaluating talent. You know, you see, and it's true for all college athletes, right? That's, you know, this guy, you know, this guy in football is a 5-star, 4-star, 3-star, blah, blah, blah. Where's the rating services for academics in America? There should be 5-star, 4-star, 3-star. Maybe I'll start this business. 5-star, 4-star, 3-star ratings, 2-star ratings for academic kids. Mm-hmm. And the 5-star kids, free everything. 4-star kids, free everything. Where are we doing this? In China, that's what they do. Mm-hmm. You know, they have this national test. And for as much as like, oh, it's so authoritarian, the reality is that test is the most it might be the most meritocratic thing on the planet. Because basically, where you do on that test, wherever you are in China, you do well, boom, you are on the fast track. You are, and that's the kind of thing we need to do. And those people are here and they're being ignored. Like, you know, I had a friend of my son's, one of my sons, and he had a 34 on his ACT. He had a 4.6 GPA. He was the valedictorian or salutatorian at his high school, one of the best high schools in the state. He was a student body president. He was a captain of one of the athletic teams. And his dad was a alum legacy at one of the best colleges in this country. And he got waitlisted. How does that happen? How does that happen? These are the people like, oh, you're anti-American. I'm not anti-American. I'm simply saying that's bullshit. Like, we're going to lose as long as that kind of thing's happening. So, you know, again, I'm rambling a little bit, but those are the things we have to fix to be able to compete to stay with them. Because you're right. Otherwise, like, we're already at that moment of, oh, God, they're cheaper and they're better.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's a stat of, you know, let's just call it production of engineers in China versus the States. And it's eclipsed by something like a 5X in China over what the US's ability to graduate productive engineers is, right?
Yeah. And it's a very, you know, that testing thing is very, you know, it's a cultural thing. I couldn't believe it when people said, but apparently it's the case where they showed me a video they took of a school, a community, sending these high-end, you know, tour buses to take their kids that were taking the test to the testing center. And people were lining the streets. And it was like something out of America in 1940, right? And it's something out of America today if you play football and you're in the national title game. You know, you get on the nice bus and they take you the bus to the stadium and the people are there, right? But that's not academic America today. You know, I sent my kids to the most academic school, middle school and grade school in the area, one of them certainly. And they used to always mandate homework for the summers and they just stopped doing that. Like, we're going in the other direction in America. Mm-hmm. That's a cultural thing. You know, you make academics great again, right? That's what another MAGA should be, is we need the 5-star academic kids need to get free school for the rest of their lives. The 4-star academic kids need to get free school. The 3-star, and you know what? The 1-star academic kids or the no star academic kids, like, those kids need to be directed into whatever interests them, not herded into college to major, you know, in some BS major because, you know, the college needs the money, and then now they're debt slaves. They're 0-star academic kids, not because they're dumb. It's just because they haven't found out what they're really smart at yet. Mm-hmm. Right. If you judge a, you know, fish by its ability to climb climb a tree, you know, you'd think every fish is stupid. You know, we need to do a better job of identifying talent. We're really good at that in sports. We're terrible at that in academics in this country. Mm-hmm.
Luke, I want to go back to, you know, maybe some of China's strategy here and something that is coming fairly soon. I believe it's the end of this week, is China's changes to the physical gold and trading markets. what is your read on A, the changes, and B, what the, let's say, what the goal of this is?
You know, Jay Martin just did a really good video on this. I retweeted it on my page, and as best I can tell, between that, between what I've heard from a number of other sources, I think it is what they are doing is some version of what the president of the Shanghai Gold Exchange, I think his name was Zhu Luodi, said in 2014, which is, you know, the gold market is, you know, consumed in the East, priced in the West. Makes no sense. When China has a right to speak in the global gold market, gold's price will be revealed. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. You can go back to U.S. declassified State Department documents from WikiLeaks in 2009 from the U.S. Beijing embassy, which says that China's official media is saying China is buying and adding to gold reserves to kill two birds with one stone. The U.S. and Europeans have always manipulated the price of gold using paper unallocated gold contracts, gold unallocated credit gold, to control the price of gold in order to support their currencies. China reserving more gold, basically calling BS on the manipulation and taking as much cheap gold as they'll sell, will bolster the internationalization prospects for the renminbi and strengthen China's FX reserves. Kill two birds with one stone. Then you go to 2009 in the BIS white paper we briefly referenced before, where the PBOC said, you know, we want a non-credit-based neutral reserve asset tied to commodities, that the John Maynard Keynes proposal of Bretton Woods was probably the better idea than the one that was ultimately chosen, the U.S.'s, you know, Harry Dexter White proposal. And so when you put those three things together, what Zhu Luodi said, what the Beijing embassy in the U.S. said the Chinese official media was saying 17 years ago, and what the PBOC said in 2009, layer in what a PBOC official said in 2015, where he said, look, you know, we want to internationalize the yuan. The mark of an internationalized currency is the ability to invoice oil and gas in yuan, and we're using gold to do that. Said that at an LBMA conference in Singapore. When you put all four of those things together, it's crystal clear, I think, what they're going to do. Now, is this it, right? This is the moment. But basically, I think when you look at what they're doing with these moves, they are getting their retail people out of paper, out of leverage, into physical, unlevered physical. Which tells me they think the price of gold is going to move a lot higher in a relatively compressed period of time. Let me add one last thing to this. In 2021, net stable funding ratio, NSFR regulations under Basel III were updated, which made it uneconomic for Western banks to hold unallocated credit gold positions. Alistair McLeod did a great piece on this in 2021. You can find it online. In it, he said that the only reason you would do this from a banking regulation standpoint is that the regulators see the unallocated gold market as a threat to banking system stability. And actually, it kind of alluded to, if it didn't say that outright, it alluded to exactly that in the BIS white paper, the actual regulatory write-up. My comment at the time, which I wrote for clients 5 years ago, which is, the bullion banks run short paper structurally, unallocated credit gold. So the only way gold could be of systemic threat to the stability of the Western banking system is if the price of gold rose really high, really fast. Mm-hmm. Reset. And so here you have in 2021, by 2022, Western banks are being told by Basel, get on sides, get out of your unallocated credit gold positions. Gold's going way higher. Now you've got the Chinese getting their citizens, get out of leverage, get into physical. So look, I don't want to say like this Friday. So apparently this Friday, these regulations are taking off. You know, is Friday the day? I don't think so. Do I think they are telling, they are communicating by their actions that sometime in the investable future, whether investable be, you know, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, 36 months, sometime we are going to have a significant rise in the price of gold in a relatively compressed period of time. I think that's what the message is. And it's been set up for years. I mean, I would even go back to 2019 when the U.S. Department of Justice, under Trump, by the way, the U.S. Department of Justice filed criminal charges, RICO, racketeering charges against J.P. Morgan's gold desk, precious metals desk. Like, my father-in-law was a Teamster official. Like, RICO scared the shit out of those guys. Like, they never went after Wall Street guys with RICO. They go after RICO, saying that the gold desk was a criminal enterprise. Department of Justice words, not mine. Mm-hmm. Having worked on a sales and trading desk for 15 plus years, what that message said, if they go after J.P. Morgan's desk that way, what the U.S. government was saying to U.S. banks, stop manipulating gold. Stop leaning on it. We want gold higher. So you've had this daisy chain of events for 7, 10, 17 years, right? So you get a lot of people say, well, the currency system will change, but it's going to take decades. Dude, we're 17 years in. We're 2 decades in. Mm-hmm. So is this it? I don't know. Could it be it? Yeah, it could be it. But I think what the Chinese are telling you is gold's going way higher. Get out of the way. And I don't know if that's 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 12 months. It's coming. Mm-hmm.
Taking a different approach to obviously this long-term view that, you know, you and I have been speaking about for many years at this point, looking at relative value, you know, if we look at the broader equities, seeing that they're overvalued in dollars, but if we look at the indexes versus gold, what is that telling us?
Oh, it's the equities are still cheap in gold terms. Gold is still cheap in equity terms. Gold is still cheap in equity terms. If you look at, you know, the Dow to gold's gone to 1 roughly in each of the last 2 major sort of economically painful eras, right? So the Great Depression went to 1. In 1980, Dow to gold went to roughly 1. And today it's what, 10, 12, 12, 12, 12 or 14. Do I think it's going to go to 1? I would sell before 1. Anything's possible, I suppose. And I want to be clear. I don't think it's going to, I think the Dow to gold ratio is going way lower. And I don't think it's going to happen mostly via the Dow going down. I think it's going to happen almost exclusively by gold going up. Because again, as we alluded to before, at least for the foreseeable future, stocks can't go down much until they create receipt problems. They create bond market problems. The stock market backs the treasury market through the receipt and through the consumer spending angle. And so, you know, Dow to gold has gone to 1 twice. I think it goes back in that direction. Is it 2? Is it 3? I don't know. Is it 4, 5, whatever. A lot lower from where we are today, 12, 15. And, you know, then we sort of stop and relook. But I think, yeah, I think my base case over the next couple of years is equities go higher in dollar terms and they go lower in gold terms. Mm-hmm.
I read a tweet this morning saying that gold seems to be uncoupling from the moves with broader equities. You know, over the beginning of the war, we saw if the Dow went down, gold went down. It was in a lot of ways behaving like a risk asset. Do you think that this is, a possible sign of the change in gold's behavior since the war began?
Yeah, I do. You know, we wrote that last week and for clients just saying, look, it, you know, gun to my head, very short term, if the war goes back on, it's probably back to that old playbook. But a day is coming and we'll be watching for it when gold starts going up, mm-hmm. with oil going up and equities going down and war back on. And that will be very interesting. And the reason I felt comfortable saying it is like, it's pretty simple. Like when we went into Iraq, gold was 330 an ounce. By February 08, it was 1,000 an ounce. By 2011, it was 2,000 an ounce. And so like war is really good for gold over time. You know, there was positioning around reserve selling, you know, what have you. But ultimately, if this war is going to go a lot longer than you think, the last thing you want to be selling is gold. Mm-hmm.
Luke, you and I have talked about Bitcoin many times here, and you seem to have moved away from mentioning it as much as you used to. Is that, you know, because your viewpoint on it has changed? Is it because of the nature of, let's say, Bitcoin has changed? How do you think about it now as an asset?
It's more just my investing viewpoint for the time being. It is, you know, to me, ultimately still an energy-based neutral reserve asset. There are some things that raise some questions around that as you look out a few years, possibly, but those things aren't issues yet as far as I can understand. You know, for me, it was just tightening liquidity, the way it was acting, you know, technically, and it still trades like a tech stock. Look today, right? Mm-hmm. Yesterday, people were like, oh, Bitcoin's gone. Woo, 66, you know, up to 66. Well, NASDAQ was up yesterday. Today, NASDAQ's down, at least when I jumped on this morning. NASDAQ's down. What's Bitcoin? Down. What's gold doing? Up. Mm-hmm. So it's still trading. Now, it has outperformed the NASDAQ, and that is interesting to me because I will say, you know, we highlighted last week, as it relates to what we were discussing earlier, that Besant and or Warsh are going to have to make a choice, the bond market or the currency, again. Every time over the last 6-7 years that Fed and or Treasury heads have been forced to choose, you know, stop Treasury market dysfunctioning by weakening the currency, Bitcoin has done really well, and it's done really well against NASDAQ. It's outperformed NASDAQ. And so I think that moment is coming again relatively soon, next 3 months, something like that, where Warsh is going to have to, he's going to have to flop his cards. Mm-hmm. You know, you a hawk or you a dove, buddy? You know, and I think his hubris is going to force him to say, I'm a tough guy in inflation. I'm going to stop him, right? And then he's going to fold like a cheap suit. And then Bitcoin runs versus NASDAQ versus gold versus sort of everything again. That's kind of my base case. And so admit it. I mean, look, I still own a little bit, but I sold the vast majority of what I owned and, you know, call it 95, 96,000, you know, 23, 24 ounces of gold. And so on. Like I'm sort of playing with house money on that front. I'm also aware of the asset class history, which is when it moves, it doesn't move slow. So mm-hmm. I'm acutely aware that I'm playing it. I'm possibly being too cute, but it's, you know, I have exposure there. It's just not as big. It's what I'm willing to take. And I'm really big in gold. And a lot of, you know, we've been seeing something else of interest, which is gold and Bitcoin have been moving, when they've been moving higher, pretty close to the same percentages, except gold has lower vol than Bitcoin. So like, I fully expect Bitcoin to resume its sort of old way of working, which is it goes higher faster than everything else once the Fed chair or Treasury and or both are forced to fold to support the Treasury market. But we're not there yet. So that's ultimately, I don't spend as much time because I don't think there's anything to do there yet on Bitcoin.
Luke, I want to be respectful of your time. I could talk to you for hours. You know, you said earlier to buy gold and sell long-dated treasuries. Is there anything else that you think is, let's say, that you want to leave our listeners with to think about in order as an idea to take action on at this time, you know, looking out, considering all of the, you know, issues that we discussed here?
I have liked, and I continue to really like, electrical infrastructure equities. Things like, if you look at the equities that are owned by the PAVE, P-A-V-E, and GRID ETFs, G-R-I-D, I don't have any relationship with any of those. But if you look at those companies, those are the types of things, you know, if we are in a Cold War, war, build out, whatever, however you want to frame it, you want to own the pick and shovel guys, right? That are selling to both sides. You want to sell the ammo makers, and electrical infrastructure is sort of the, I think, the ammo makers. I don't have to have a view on how this is going to go. It's going to take longer than expected, and it's going to be more expensive than expected. Both of those two things are good for the PAVE and GRID. I think Japan, and in particular Japanese industrial equities, probably they've done fairly well. They've not done as well as the Japanese overall stock market, but I think, forget about what I think, the reality is the United States cannot reshore on its own. We waited too long. We don't have the people. We don't have the infrastructure. And so we are going to need to depend on some companies in Europe, a few industrial companies, and those are probably, you know, things, you know, different, you know, sort of Siemens, you know, ABB type things, right? Industrials. Depend on China. Well, we're trying not to. Still kind of are, but we're trying not to. Or Japan. And to a lesser extent, Korea. But Korea is a bit of a weird stock market because there's so much of it is it's memory and trading like Doge right now. But I think Korea's economy ultimately benefits from this as well. But Japan and Japanese industrials, the U.S. cannot. And regardless of how we think it's going to go for the U.S., the U.S. is going to try. And if the U.S. tries, Japanese industrials are going to do well. And so that's another one I would, those are some other things I would highlight that I think stand to, from, as you look at 6, 12, 18 months, should, you know, I think you'll be happy with that 6, 12, 18 months from now.
What about picks and shovels within the gold mining industry?
I still like gold miners too. thank you for the prompt. It's gold miners, still one of my biggest positions. It's been, it was at a great, I've owned them for going on 7 years. They've been one of my biggest positions, and I've not sold any of them. Last 5 months have been painful. I get it. The gold to oil ratio which is a proxy for their profitability, has shrunk, but, I think gold to oil ratio is ultimately going way, way higher, right? You got the U.S. Treasury Secretary talking about Hamiltonian economics. That means gold's got to go way higher. It has to, which means gold to oil ratio has to go way higher, which means gold mining profitability has to go way higher over time. And the valuations of these gold miners, they're trading as if the market doesn't believe gold's going to stay at 4,000. They're trading like gold's going back to 1,800. Mm-hmm. And I suppose anything's possible, but I'd be shocked if that happens. So yeah, I still really like gold miners secularly. I mean, just the cash flow these things are throwing off is like, I saw someone talk about it the other day. I've not done the math myself, but I think they were saying they were like 20-25% cash flow yields. I was like, by way of comparison, when we were doing equity, you know, I was doing bottoms up equity research. If we had a company that was like a 10-12% cash flow yield, it was like, oh my God, it was like, you know, unbelievable in terms of the attractiveness. I don't know that I've ever seen a 20-25% free cash flow yield company. Like, holy cow. So, you know, sentiment on them is death. 20% cash flow yields, maybe. Again, I can't remember who was saying it, but it was somebody pretty reputable. So I'm taking them at their word, but take that with a grain of salt. And I think gold to oil ratio and miner profitability is going a lot higher, and the market's just like sleeping on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Luke, it's always a great pleasure to, you know, be a little bit selfish with some of your time. I really, really appreciate it. Of course, for anybody that wants to read more of your stuff, on X at Luke Groman, G-R-O-M-E-N, and of course, fftt-llc.com. Luke, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being back on, Tom. It's great talking with you.